The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
Well, the housing crisis continues to worsen in Metro Vancouver, with rents skyrocketing far beyond the reach of most families, especially those on low incomes. And with welfare rates largely unchanged, only rising by $175 a month recently, housing is still out of reach. But a new report by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives chief economist has found that rents could actually be much cheaper if governments took development of rental housing out of the hands of private developers and instead created nonprofit housing developers that could significantly save costs. Here is Mark Lee, a senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, talking about their new report, How to Build Affordable Rental Housing in Vancouver. Mark, thanks for joining us here on The Pulse on CFRO.
No problem.
Great to have you back. Thank you for returning, and really fascinated about your latest research because you've crunched the numbers on housing and came to some interesting conclusions. And I know housing is top of mind for a lot of our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I think I came to this research basically being frustrated with the conversation we are having in Metro Vancouver around building affordable housing and this presumption that, you know, building affordable housing is just too expensive. Land prices are too high, construction costs are spiraling out of control, development fees and bureaucratic processes are all stifling projects. And there's definitely some truth in each of those explanations.
And we were seeing some projects that were claiming to be affordable, but then the rate of affordability was so out of reach for anyone on a moderate or low income.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, basically what our model has been over the last couple of decades has been big developer-led mega projects. And then, you know, governments come in and try to negotiate a little bit of affordable housing, you know, that's kind of ratcheted on or attached onto the this mega project, and generally leads to very little genuine affordable housing. And also, in order to access that, like taller buildings, you know, bigger projects that then tend to rile up neighborhood opposition. So we have a model that's really not working in a number of respects, unless you're in the market for a luxury condo.
Now, we had a number of names for this model over the years. I believe the current name is Moderate Income Rental Housing Pilot Program. There used to be one called STIR, and then the Son of STIR, some people called it. All of these depended on market rate buildings. And tell me a little bit about how you crunch the numbers to come up with why the costs are so expensive.
Yeah, I mean, the projects you're pointing to are like private sector led projects, wherein governments are trying to move the needle a bit away from just straight up luxury condos towards more affordable options, but they're still playing in the same basic sandbox. And what I'm saying with my research is we need to change the game. Rather than looking at a developer that's going to build to what the market will bear, whether that's, you know, strata condos or market rental, let's look at the costs of actually building housing.
Can you give me some numbers here? Like, what are we looking at for a sort of average rental unit cost for a one bedroom when you work with the private sector, with developers?
Well, I mean, if you're looking at a new private sector building coming online, you're probably looking at, you know, $2,300 to $2,500 for a one bedroom unit. So it's pretty expensive for even fairly affluent folks to pay that kind of money. So what we did is to instead look at it from the ground up and look at all those different cost factors and then try to drive down those costs in each of those segments. And, you know, one of the ways we do that is simply by getting rid of the private sector developers. And we switch to a nonprofit development model so that the mandate of the organization making the building is consistent with the broader societal objectives of building more affordable housing.
Now, you mentioned in your report there's often a 15% at least developer profit margin, and that doesn't even probably include the costs of getting through the bureaucracy and the paperwork and applying for many years.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are a lot of costs that developers bear, but I don't think we need to shed any tears for them. That 15% is kind of an assumed rate of profit. Often, you know, if a project goes well, if the market swings higher, depending on the particular cost factors at play, their profit margins could be substantially higher. So by going with a nonprofit model, we can focus on what it actually costs to build the housing, and then therefore, what are the rents we need to charge in order to make that building pay for itself over time. So it's a very different way of looking at it.
The other thing that you kind of looked at is land cost. And I know this is a big thing that I looked at when I did a housing series for the Tai years ago. But there's not just, you know, one way to purchase land. And in fact, governments own a lot of land.
Yeah, I mean, I think we would start with contributed land from municipal, provincial, or federal governments, or land that's contributed by churches and nonprofits. And, you know, when we look across the region, there's a lot of land available. We could also start buying up land in kind of more low density detached neighborhoods where the cost of land is, you know, relatively low, at least if you're going to then eventually upzone that to something that's more like a multi-unit building. So there are different ways of getting around the land issue. But I think long-term, what we need is a mechanism that basically taxes some of the windfall gains in real estate that have accrued to homeowners across the region and puts that to use in terms of buying land for this affordable housing build-out.
I mean, think of all the money that would be available if people didn't get a homeowner's grant every year just for owning a condo or house.
Yeah, about $820 million per year would be available simply from that. I mean, you know, we've done other work around the homeowner grant and argue that what we really should have is in a means-tested grant that goes to renters and owners alike, but it would be targeted towards the lowest income folks in each of those categories, rather than giving the same dollar amount to any homeowner, you know, all the way up to the richest people in the province.
Right. So basically, based on the percentage of your income that goes to your rent, kind of thing, whether you have affordable housing or not.
Or just based on your straight up income. There are other models as well. Manitoba has this great model called Rent Assist, where they pay the gap between you know, your income and 75% of the median rent. So that basically it means that landlords can't capture the increase in benefits to the individual in higher rents.
So let's look at the cheapest possible way you figured out to build housing. So a nonprofit model, they don't have to buy the land because it's already contributed from a church or government or nonprofit, and wood frame building because that's cheaper to build for multi-use buildings. What's the kind of comparison? Can you kind of guide us through for like a one bedroom or two bedroom apartment?
We would also want to have to continue to have the municipal fees, so development cost levies and community amenity contributions waived, which generally happens now for market rentals and other nonprofit development anyways. Similarly for the federal GST. And then we'd also want to do things like eliminate parking requirements. So we spend a lot of money in this city digging huge holes in the ground. You know, to build underground parking that's like 4 or 5 stories deep is incredibly expensive, and that just adds to the final price tag. So simply just waiving those parking requirements, if developers feel they need some parking, they can go ahead and build it, but generally they're not going to build anywhere near as much as they're required to build right now. So you add all those different cost factors into the mix, and basically when we look at it over 50 years of payback period, we can get a one bedroom for $1,273 per month. So it's still not necessarily the cheapest in the world, but it's a rent that's justified, that covers the operating costs of being in that unit and the upfront capital and construction costs.
But that would be a lot higher for a private developer. We're talking almost $2,000 just to build that.
Yeah, like, I mean, basically half of what it would cost, you know, under that private development model. And then, you know, for a two bedroom, it's like $1,640 per month. And for a three bedroom, it's just over $2,000 per month. So things are much, much lower than what we're seeing from the private marketplace.
Now, for a lot of our listeners who are perhaps even that's out of range, I mean, people have been so left behind by the housing market at every level. You found a way of getting it a bit lower than that for people who are on social assistance or lower income. And it reminds me very much of the co-op model. Tell me about how you could get the rent even lower than that for some of the residents.
Yeah, I mean, we simply have cross subsidies across the different units. That and these could apply within one building, or it could be across a series of buildings, but the math works out the same. So say you had a building with 30 units. On average, if to say that they're all one bedrooms, for example, they would be $1,273 per month. But if instead we said, okay, a third of the units will rent at that average, a third will rent closer to a market rate of like almost $1,800 a month, and then the remaining third could rent at $750 per month, which would basically make it affordable for someone making $30,000 of yearly income at you know, the affordability level of 30% of household income. So it's a cross subsidy, but allows us to get deeper levels of affordability.
Now, in Greater Vancouver right now, the average monthly rent is officially around $1,250, but that's for people who includes people who have been in their tenancies for a long time. You're seeing things going on the market now for, you know, $1,600. So it does actually kind of match your data for new builds. The rents are just, it's not possible to get them lower with the current model.
Yeah, I mean, I think what this model does is it anchors it in some harsh realities that, you know, building housing does cost money. You know, you do have to have these various outlays, but, you know, you also have a stream of income in the form of rent that pays back that upfront cost over time. And, you know, when you're doing it at a nonprofit model, if you have like financing through CMHC at, you know, 2% and you have 50 years, you can basically pay that back. And then if the building lasts 100 or, you know, even 200 years, then all of those years after year 50 is basically profit that's coming back to the public sector that could be reinvested.
This is so fascinating, and it's good to have some actual concrete numbers to put on this. Is there a place, do you think, for the co-op housing model? Because that cross subsidy is obviously something that co-ops have long practiced. And I assume that that's also a way of potentially doing nonprofit housing.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm talking about non-market housing, I'm definitely including co-ops in there. That would be the main model. I sort of, there's a slight difference in the sense that there's the people who are building housing. So you have for-profit developers and then not-for-profit housing developers. So that's the kind of the crux of the construction, getting the stuff built side. But then what is built, you would want to be run either as a co-op or through some nonprofit or publicly organized community housing. There's a lot of different ways you could go about doing that. But basically taking the profit out of housing and removing the financialization that's causing such problems in the housing market.
So the kind of cross subsidy you discussed to get the one bedroom down to $750 a month, you say that that would be basically affordable for somebody at $30,000 a year salary, because we have this definition of affordability at 30% of your income should not go to housing. What about people below that?
Well, I mean, you could design the cross subsidy in any number of different ways, but it means that, you know, you need to have higher rents somewhere else within that building or series of buildings. So, you know, you could go lower, but I think $750 a month was, you know, was reasonable as just for one approximation. Beyond that, you know, people with very low incomes do need additional public support, either income support or rental supports in order to have affordability. So, you know, what the model's doing is looking at the straight up bare bones economics. Like, how do you build housing that covers its costs over time through the rents that are received?
Let's talk about scaling this up to a level that could actually make it more affordable as well. What are some of the ways that we could actually, if we embrace this model, this nonprofit housing model? And I know the BC Nonprofit Housing Association has been pushing for this for many years and has a few projects off on the go with the, you know, co-op federation and that kind of thing. But what's it going to take to get this into much, you know, meeting the actual needs? Because we need tens of thousands of units, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, we did other research, you know, today's report is kind of at the micro level, but at the macro level, region-wide, we need like 10,000 new non-market units coming on stream every year. And we need that for at least a generation. You know, it's going to take a while to build ourselves out of the current affordable housing crisis. So that's the type of scale we need to build on. And if we actually start getting the wheels in motion, then we can actually have lower costs because we're developing economies of scale in the production of this housing. We could shift more towards sort of more modularized forms of construction where instead of building everything on site, you know, you have factories outside of town that are building prefabricated panels that just get dropped into place and get assembled on site, a little bit like IKEA furniture is. But we've done that very successfully.
Hopefully more solidly glued together.
Well, I mean, the temporary modular housing that you're seeing around the city is an example of that model, but we've been doing this, you know, in other places for a long time. So I didn't really go into that in detail. I think it's a future cost savings, but it's not one that I built into the model right away. But certainly, we need to scale things up. We have a precedent in BC and in Canada. You know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and we built a lot of public and nonprofit housing. And in other countries, you know, whether it's Singapore or Austria, they've done the same. They've had a lot more direct public intervention in the development of affordable housing.
If people want to actually see it firsthand, go to, you know, the south side of False Creek, and there's that all of those buildings that look like they're, you know, from the 1970s future are this mix of, you know, subsidized housing and co-op housing and strata leasehold housing that, you know, was meant to have a 30-30-30 balance of incomes. And it's still there.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, that model still exists and it still works. So we should be going back to our roots on this stuff.
You mentioned earlier about, you know, ways of financing this and kind of how to get some revenues out of the kind of wealthier homeowner sector. I know that some people have talked a lot about a land value capture tax. So for as the proper price of land goes up, people have been making a windfall off speculation. Do you have any sort of proposals or ideas on that debate?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that, you know, overall property taxes should be higher in Vancouver. They're actually quite low compared to other parts of Canada. I would concentrate that increased property tax on the land portion, which is essentially the core idea behind land value capture, as opposed to the buildings themselves. And then I also bring in more progressive tiers on property tax. So we did this provincially with the higher rates on the school tax, which kick in at, I think, $2 million of value.
This is, like, of course, the tax the NDP brought in that had a whole bunch of Westsiders yelling about their houses being expropriated by the government.
Yeah, which tells you that the tax is effective, right? Because those are the folks that should be paying a lot higher taxes because they're the ones who've made huge capital gains in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars that will never pay a cent of income tax under the current rules.
And I see in your acknowledgements that you work pretty closely with a bunch of folks who are pretty seasoned at data analysis at the Nonprofit Housing Association. So great to have a shout out to them.
Yeah. And I, in doing this model, I worked with some nonprofit housing developers as well to just verify the numbers so that they are reflecting the real world conditions that they are facing in building housing.
What's the big takeaway? If you were, you know, had the ear of the government and they said, what can be done right now? This is a big idea, but we don't have the sector yet, you know, shovel ready. How do we get it shovel ready?
Well, I mean, build big, you know, start using that public land and plan for a really big build out. There's an upfront cost to getting this stuff built, but it pays for itself over time. And that's the key thing, is that you're not just giving money away, you're actually building an asset that has a stream of income tied to it over time that pays for those upfront costs. So really, it's just getting over the hump of that upfront cost. There's no reason why we can't do this. And if governments are serious about doing it, then they have to move away from trying to attach a little bit of affordable housing onto developer-led mega projects and start building the housing that we actually genuinely need.
This sounds like a job for perhaps some kind of a housing agency, some big vision project like they used to have in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, I mean, Vancouver created, the city of Vancouver created this Vancouver Affordable Housing Agency, you know, with that in mind several years ago, but it's never really been given the room to move and become what housing advocates had hoped for. But certainly, you know, BC Housing could get back in this game in a big way. CMHC, the federal agency, could get back in this game in a big way. There's a lot of scope for, you know, municipal development corporations and nonprofit development corporations, and maybe some capacity associated with scaling up their operations. But it's definitely can be done, and you know, the cost of doing nothing is we can already see that every day.
Thank you so much for your time and for breaking down these numbers for us, Mark.
All right, take care. Thanks.
Thank you so much. And that was Mark Lee, a senior economist with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. You can find the report "How to Build Affordable Rental Housing in Vancouver" at policyalternatives.ca.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.